Welcome to the Home Base Podcast, the podcast where we explore the keys to college success and personal growth. I'm your host, Dr. Ricky Pope, and today we're deep diving into how students can survive and thrive in their college journey. For this first series, we're collaborating with the Young Men of Color Alliance, an organization committed to supporting young men of color through mentorship and community initiatives. Today's episode will focus on giving you the tools and strategies to take control of your academic experience. We will discuss the importance of developing agency and the power to make choices, shape your future, and overcome obstacles. Welcome to the Home Base Podcast. All right. So I'm sitting down with Kasimu Harley today. He's a pioneer in education and outreach and healing and wellness and all the things he's gonna tell you about today as we get to know him. Most importantly is his pioneering work with young men in particular and just how that's been helpful. So I'm really excited to sit down with him and interview him and just get an understanding of his work. So welcome to the Home Base Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, brother. Appreciate it.
So tell me about some of your early work with young men of color, with African-American males in particular. How's that work?
Much of my work began even before, you know, I got here to San Diego State. I was actually here in the 80s, and I worked in student affairs and started as a EOP recruiter. Mm-hmm. And then I went on to work at the Student Outreach Center. Back then, we had the Student Outreach Center was in Quonset Huts then. And now, you know, that's been gentrified. The campus has been gentrified. Mm-hmm. You know, looking really great now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. My work with young men began really at the old Aztec Center. The students were in Aztec Center, and I asked them the question, initially started out with the statement, you know, you all act like you don't belong, but when people treat you like that, you want to get angry. Mm-hmm. And then I just walked away. And so in that instance, it kind of created some energy because I saw the students then began to organize. You know, I think I'm partly responsible for some of the organization, but many of the students were taking Africana Studies classes. And that piqued their interest as well. So some of the students that were part of that time were now the Dr. Sean Jenright, mm-hmm. who did teach at San Francisco State, but now he's teaching at Harvard. Now Dr. Daniel Walker, who was the former ASB president. Sophia Nelson, who is an attorney, but now she's someone who actually started a PAC to support the candidacy of Kamala Harris. Mm-hmm. And the interesting piece is that during that time, and Sophia was, you know, and was unapologetically a Republican. She basically interfaced with many of the students within the African Student Union, because they changed it at the time from the Black Student Union to the African Student Union. And that was a reflection of the consciousness raising that had been done by the professors in the Africana Studies Department. Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. Shirley Weber, the late Dr. Shirley Thomas, you know, and Professor Wade. A number of folks were there.
What was important about that distinction going from Black Studies or to the Africana Studies?
Well, one of the things that the students were interested in doing was not separating the African diaspora, okay, mm-hmm. and that whole notion of the connection of people from Africa, even though you were, you know, centuries removed, to folks that were either recent immigrants or, you know, from the African diaspora, you know, those folks that had come from the Caribbean and other parts of the world, mm-hmm. so that there was a connectivity that they wanted to explore and maintain. And actually develop more in depth about looking at that. And that's spurred a level of activism on the campus that Daniel Walker and that group, and actually Daniel's sister was a part of it. It's Walker as well. But a number of students, so there was this groundswell of what was possible here on the campus for students that happened to be of African descent, right? Mm-hmm. And so they began to organize, and Daniel became one of the presidents of the Associated Student Body. And that whole group, there were a number of things that had happened. So I was also the coordinator of the Student Leadership Institute at the time. And so one of the things for me, even then, was how do we create a campus where all people belong, right? Mm. And so many of the students that happened to be African-American, Latino, they weren't really represented in the Associated Student Government at the time. However, when the students organized, that shifted. And so it began to reflect the broad diversity of the campus. And I believe student government now reflects the diversity of the campus, whereas before it was kind of a singular diversity or singular ethnicity mm-hmm. that represented student government. And so with that, there became just, this drive, that many of the students had to make the campus different and an enriched experience for them. And then at that time, there was also the Panhellenic Council. There was all the Greek letter organizations where it was a vibrant time. And so there was a Greek show that was held, mm-hmm. In actually the whole open air theater. There were dances in the old Montezuma Hall. Mm. So it was a vibrant atmosphere that was created for students here. And matter of fact, students came from L.A., San Francisco, and even Arizona to be a part of the Greek show experience that was here. And that in itself, and then also it was open for people in the community to come, Mm. So that particular time was a time where, if anyone had said San Diego State wasn't a welcoming environment, they weren't the folks that were here. Mm. Because even though the population was small, I think it was 4% at the time, it's probably still around the same. Mm-hmm. But students claimed their space. And they were unapologetically, who they were and represented that. My challenge as being in person in student affairs was sometimes with the some of the Greek letter organizations in terms of some of their conceptions around, what constituted hazing and all those things. And if I was in my office and I didn't get a call from the dean on a Monday about an incident, it was a good day. it was funny because the dean would call and, Kasimu, do you have a minute? Course, I mean, you're my boss. What am I going to say? Mm-hmm. No, I don't have a minute. Yeah. Right. So, but anyway, the organizations, and this was the other part that was significant about that time. The Greek letter organizations, when they held the Greek shows and all of that, they raised over $50,000 in a weekend mm-hmm. with those events. And, the Panhellenic Council, pretty much decided, they would decide how they would divide the revenue, okay? And one of the things I was always trying to push them to do was to set up an endowment for it. Hey, you guys have you thought about doing something different? And just kind of longevity. But again, can only influence and not really push because I was just the advisor. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the things. And then we also had the high school conference. And that was always a challenge in terms of because, one, we wanted the high school conference that brought other African-American students to campus to be, very solid event And so sometimes with planning and students, their commitment was to school. And so sometimes, you know, we had gaps in, you know, what was going on. And now, and the part that I was happy about, because I heard the other day that now there's a faculty member that's an active part of that. And I think in the past, we didn't have that. I was in student affairs and doing multiple things. And so we would attempt to provide the structure and support. And we did the best we could at the time. But that was just another thing that I had to do. And, you know, I was one person, but I was the advisor to the majority of the African-American organizations on campus, you know. And so I just remember that time as a vibrant time. And I'm actually still in touch with Dr. Sean Jenwright and Daniel Walker. And I actually send a note to Sophia on Instagram occasionally when she posts something about. And the interesting thing about Sophia is she even had time with, because she's in the D.C. area, she even had time with
with one of the justices.
She actually spent time with him.
It's gonna bother you.
Yeah, it's gonna bother me because it's like the first thing I thought about was Anita Hill. Mm-hmm. And
my Clarence Thomas.
Yes. Okay. Yes, it was Clarence. I mean, okay. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm gonna give him his respect.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
She kind of filled me in on some things, you know, just kind of having that experience. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting about even Sophia, and if you ever get the time, check out some of her Instagram stuff now, because she has several books out now, as well as Dr. Sean Jenwright has several books out now, and it shows just what that environment could do. Now, Dr. Sean Jenwright went on to create a program called Leadership Excellence, mm-hmm. and it started with an idea because he mentioned to me, he said, hey, you know, I'm thinking about doing something for African-American students. I said, okay, because I was doing the Leadership Institute for the university. Mm-hmm. So he did. And actually, it was a San Diego event. And the irony of that is, like, 2 years ago, I was at an event in the South Bay, and a couple of the students that went through his program as high school students are active, and they've created programs to support African-American students, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So Dr. Sean Jenwright his wife, Nedra, they actually were in the Bay Area and created Camp Akili. Mm-hmm. And Camp Akili brought together students in the Oakland area, high school students, young people, and did a camp with them that took them through a whole experience. So that was going on for over 30 years. So he's since been able to step back from that, but that they were just able to do some work in Philadelphia with Camp Akili. And mm-hmm. so a lot of great stuff has been happening just with Dr. Sean Wright, Sophia Nelson, one of the brothers that wrote for the Daily Aztec, his last name is Williams, but he wrote for the Daily Aztec. And he became a major producer for some of the hip hop shows that are on, right? The Unsung series, right? So there's a lot of things that came out of that particular time that the students were here. And it was out of that 80s period. Out of the 80s period.
So is it something about the 80s? Is it something about your mentorship style as a leader? Like, what do you...
I can't take all the credit, but I think one of the things, it was really about the combination of the professors that were here and then challenging the students to claim their space, right?
Yeah, you mentioned that. What do you mean by claim your space?
Well, one of the things, sometimes in terms of, many times I believe African-American students and many students play it small, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes you're in spaces where that notion that Claude Steele talks about in terms of stereotype threat and those things may enter your mind, and so you begin to play yourself small. And so that's what I'm talking about, just stepping in, claiming your space, and recognizing, yeah, there may be some things that you need to work on. However, you earn the right to be in this space, and you no need to cower to anyone mm-hmm. at that point. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the other part about all the things that can enter one's mind about being, you know, of African descent in a predominantly, you know, Caucasian university, some of the things that may seep into, you know, your perspective about being here, right? Maybe feeling a sense of isolation or not understood and all those things. Well, part of it when claiming your space is finding the folks that support you, your aspirations and dreams, and being open to allies that support your dreams, because they see you. They see you for who you are and respect you for who you are, and you can move with that as opposed to playing small.
Mm-hmm. It makes a lot of sense. It sounds like that's a timeless message, central to the 80s and the folks that you're working with, but I'm thinking to the young men of color that I'm working with. I talk about shrinking down the campus and really finding your home base. And mm-hmm. so who are those people? Where are those spaces that allow you to feel supported, connected, nurtured? And so when I hear you saying take up space, right, I'm hearing some overlap. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, claim your space. And one of the things, and I need to mention also, because I came in as an EOP recruiter, and the late Gus Chavez mm-hmm. was, you know, I would consider him one of my mentors, mm-hmm. As well as Dr. Weber, you know, Dr. Thomas. I was a student at UCSD, but the irony in that is that my roommates were students here. And so at the time, the Total Theatrical Black Experience, which was started by Dr. Danny Scarborough, was here. And this is still like the 70s, you know, on into the 80s. But Dr. Scarborough, that was the other thing that was happening here in terms of what he created. And the dance troupe, you know, he took folks that were not even dancers. I mean, it was not even a dancer.
Wow.
And then basically molded them into this vibrant dance troupe that performed in San Diego, Riverside. And then he even had a summer program where he went to the East Coast and taught. And so that was it. So many of the people that were in the program, Donna Ingram, Ava Beard, Stephen Beard, you know, a number of folks that I'm picturing in my mind, like, you know, I'm not recalling in many of the names, but they were part of that experience. So that was that experience. And then in Dr. Danny Scarborough's class, a scholar. So in terms of in his literature class, you'd be reading Zora Neale Hurston mm-hmm. and, you know, a lot of the greats. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about influence between the work of the late Dr. Shirley Thomas and Dr. Danny Scarborough, all of those folks, Dr. Weber, all the foundation they laid mm-hmm. in cultivating the intellectual capacities of the students that were there, that was one of the things that fueled it in part. And then my part in that was being in student affairs with the Leadership Institute, mm-hmm. pushing that a little bit. How do we help you develop those skills even further? Right. Mm. So that was one of the things when I really consider it, you know, those are things that really drove it. And the whole idea of claiming space. And that was so one of the things that happened with me here, even when I did recruitment, was I began to look at those schools because there was a gentleman. This is the other part about founding ILIs. There was a gentleman that worked in the data analysis office. And at the time they were doing Fortran, you know, and COBOL and C. And I went down to him to find out where were we recruiting our African-American students from? What mm-hmm. were the schools? And he he'd run a list for me, and he called me, and we used to play racquetball together, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that was the other part of finding, like when you say finding your people. And, you know, this was a Caucasian man, but really he was like, I asked him a question about the data. He's like, okay, he found the data for me. I was able, and then I started going to some of those schools, okay? And so then with that, in terms of bringing some of those students here, so what we begin to see was a cycle of where we got students from, right? So that was, so those, and that was, that kind of predated when people were doing like serious like data analysis to see where we got students from, right? And so that was the other piece, and that was exciting because I could go to some places and try and cultivate, you know, bringing a larger number of, you know, African American students here, and so that was one of the things that I saw. But then during the Student Leadership Conference or the Leadership Institute, some of the work that I had done was with the National Conference of Christians and Jews, which came to the National Conference for Communities and Justice, around bringing diverse groups together. And then it was work that I'd done with Dr. Norm Chambers with the Carl Rogers Institute, which focused on cultural diversity. But he also has going to something called Living Now that was in La Jolla. But it brought together folks from around the world that identified with the teachings of Carl Rogers and a person-centered approach. So that was a part of how do I create a community where folks can be in a space and respect and appreciate each other and move on. Well, my first evaluation from the Leadership Institute, I still remember students was like, Kasimu stuck in the 60s, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah, okay, maybe. But really, it was a part of it. It was one of the activities that I had one of my colleagues do. And that was to break down some of the barriers, right? So that was one of the things. So I would say that those were some of the experiences that kind of helped me develop a facilitation style that was really trying to draw students out. And then the other piece was there was an article that was written years ago called Rumors of Inferiority. And in that article, that was my first introduction to Claude Steele and stereotype threat. And so he had talked about a young lady who had gone to an Ivy League school, who basically had been a 4.0 student, honors classes, all that, got there, and someone basically mentioned that maybe she got there as a affirmative action kid. And what that did to her psyche was the piece that's important, is that because of the internalization of that, her grades began to fall, and she transferred. And Dr. Steele was basically at the point he wished he had gotten to her earlier so that he could have, you know, kind of talked to her about that process. And so that's the other part. So I think that what many students, many African-American students have to do, and this could apply to others, however, is when I talk about claiming your space, it's really pushing away from definitions that others have of you so that you can begin to really look at, okay, what are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? And separate yourself from some of how others define you, right? And that's it. So that's one of the things. So when I talk about, so I believe education is about liberation in all dimensions. And so the dimension of not only understanding yourself and how you fit into the world and how you can potentially make a difference, the other part is how do you understand yourself in terms of in a racialized society and empower and embrace your empowerment so that you can chart your own destiny.
Well, even going back to your example of the young lady in Claude Steele's research, right? So another piece of that is that you divert that cognitive energy that you would be using to pass the class. Now you're using that energy to disprove the stereotype, right? And so like that you know, that's really slowing you down. And here's this person with the 4.0 who's done all the work. And so yeah, that's really powerful research. I appreciate you highlighting that.
Yeah, and the thing about it is that we have to help our folks understand. And then even some of the early research, because I remember in my early college years, I had a professor who happened to be African American. He said his idea of a beautiful woman was Marilyn Monroe. That's not a problem. That's not a problem. However, the class I was in was sociology from a Black perspective. And so my question to him was, how come we weren't using books by African American artists, authors? And he didn't have a response. So each time I went to class, we would do this dance on what he was writing, because there was an assignment to write about marginal man. And one of the things that I had written was, because a concept is, you know, basically how you fit into a society, right? Mm-hmm. Whether you're actually a part of that or you kind of on the margins. And that was kind of my understanding of it. And so I was like, okay, I can see I have this dual existence, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, it's former Marine, you know, was in the Marine Corps. But I also remember my DIs one day saying, when all the brothers had pushed, we had all kind of gravitated towards each other, and they came down and basically separated us again. And then when one of the brothers was walking, he said, don't be pulling that Black Power shit on me. Right. Mm-hmm. So, and then with growing up in segregated Philadelphia, all those things and those racialized experiences that I had there, I was like, yeah, I have a marginal existence, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, I am in America, and I'm a part of this. I've made attempts to be a full-fledged part of this by, you know, considering myself a patriot and joining the Marine Corps. But you still see me not as, right? Mm-hmm. So those pieces. So me and this professor danced about that. And I ended up leaving the class because it was too taxing on me. Then when I saw other folks from the class on campus, they was like, "Wow, I wish you hadn't done that, because we really learned a lot when you all did that dance." I said it was too taxing on me. So when you picture that, you know, a professor who is really not educated, but he was tasked to do a class to capture African American scholarship around sociology, but he didn't have the background to do it or the bandwidth, right? Mm-hmm. So, and it would have been different. I mean, it would have been different. So that was a challenging experience early on. So when I met folks like Starla Lewis, who was a former student here, she was like one of my first professors, because I was a student at Palomar College for a while. That was another piece. So that kind of created this legacy. Then I was exposed to Dr. Charles Thomas. Then I was exposed to the late Dr. Asa Hilliard. And then some of the other scholars that they would bring around. That was the other thing that happened, because I was a student at UCSD. My professors there made it a point to not only engage us, but let us experience other African-American scholars that were in their circle. And that was something that that always stuck with me, you know. And then even my other professors that happened to be in that department, even being in La Jolla, you know, they would you'd be at their house taking a class.
So earlier today, I was shooting some content, and on that content, I'm imploring students to go to office hours and talk to their faculty. Mm-hmm. And so as I'm listening to you today, it sounds like your life has been enriched by having these mentors cross-generationally, across institutional campuses, and then also you've mentored people. So there's, I would call it like bi-directional mentorship, right? So you're getting mentored by someone else, and then you're mentoring, and that makes your mentorship, you know what, different questions to ask, because other people are asking you questions, and just a rich sauce. And so how has mentorship in kind of both directions influenced your life?
Wow. I mean, I want to start out with first mentors from elementary school. Mm. I have my fifth and sixth grade teacher, Mr. King, was one of those people that stood out. It was Miss Dorsey Elementary School. Mr. King was the type of person who basically charged us to move beyond the neighborhood. Mm. He had my brother and I audition for the All Philadelphia Boys Choir. And for years I thought, well, we just auditioned. And my brother reminded me, he said, no, we were in the choir. I said, oh, okay. But on a subway ride back home where I kind of got lost, you know, that kind of ended that career. But Mr. King was a pivotal person. But then here's the other part. High school, and I cannot remember her name, but she was one of the folks that was a monitor in the school. It was an older sister. And I remember I was cutting class one day. And didn't want to go to PE and was leaving, was going out the door. I was coming back in. Because, you know, you come back in for the next class. Mm-hmm. And she gave me a satchel of books. And the books were on African-American history and culture. Mm. Right? So that was the other piece. Then it was also just kind of seeing the work of, you know, my mom and my dad. And then growing up witnessing the experience of my sister, my older sister, my brother-in-law, who happened to be members of the Nation of Islam at the time, but transitioned after the assassination of Malcolm X into more Orthodox Islam. That evolution, hearing those conversations. So there was all the seeding that was happening. And then even seeing the experiences in my neighborhood, you know, it was very racialized because I'm a child of the 50s, 60s into the 70s. So there's a lot going on that kind of peppered my understanding of the world and where I fit into it. Fast forward that to even experiences that I had in the Marine Corps, mm-hmm. where the Native American sergeant, you know, telling me about, you know, attitude and all those things and how I would be perceived and those things. And then even having some officers that happened to be Caucasian who basically, you know, saw in me some things that leadership in me that they wanted to basically push forward, right? Hmm. So all of those pieces. So I think that the there was a peppering of experiences along, and then you fast forward to the college experience, my early experience with Starla Lewis, who was also influenced by Dr. Shirley Weber, who was influenced by Dr. Charles Thomas. You know, and then all the folks that were here. So it just kind of moves on. Then running into Dr. Norm Chambers and then his exposure to Carl Rogers and then the Living Now folks and all those things. So all of that has come together into this really rich experience for me that kind of tempered my approach to, like, mentoring. My approach to even facilitating, because I always tell folks, even as a practicing family therapist, I always tell folks that I'm just a facilitator of a process, right? Mm. And I can only go as far as you want to go, and so those are things. But I think that the benefit is, one is having the courage to go in and recognize that you got to kind of sublimate your ego, you know. And, you know, take it from the big E to the small E, mm-hmm. and kind of be able to go in and ask some critical questions and then challenge yourself to step up your game, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, because you have an expert that's available to you, and why not avail yourself to the opportunity to grow in a way that is going to stretch your comfort zone? Mm-hmm.
Some of the mentors you mentioned, I do know. So Starla was able to present to the Young Men of Color this semester, this year. How did she influence you?
Well, one of the things, I had a couple classes of hers, and it was really, well, actually, that professor I had who happened to be at Palomar College, the paper, I wrote a paper that he graded me down on, and at the time, you know, I had Starla read it, and basically, it was a totally different perspective on it. Mm-hmm. So that was the other part. So that was how my initial exposure to her. Then I ended up at Palomar taking some classes. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's a key takeaway, I guess, from all of your mentors that you take into your work with your mentees?
I think the one of the things is, that's a really great question, because I think what I think of when I think about it, it's really about the ability to even listen to them, listening to the mentee in a deep way to kind of capture what it is that they're passionate about, and to be able to not in a pushy way, but to be able to help them see their strengths and the assets that they have, but also to see the areas of growth that they need to work on to push forward. And you know, that's because that's one of the things. It's almost like listening to them and not really like from a whole judgment piece, but okay, you want to be like, I remember, and this is one for the I had a student when I worked at UCSD. I was a guidance aide for a program called CalSOAP, the Student Opportunity Access Program. And I remember talking to this student, and it was at Hoover High School. And I asked him, was he planning to go to college? Because that was the focus. You know, we were trying to get students at least thinking about college, doing all the financial aid applications and wherever they were going to apply to. This particular student told me, no, I don't think I'm going to go to school. I said, oh, okay. I said, well, what are you going to do? He said, well, I'm going to play baseball. I said, oh, okay. I said, all right. I had no idea that student got picked up by the Toronto Blue Jays. He had already signed. And so, but what I was pleased about is in the off season, he said he was going to continue his education, right? And so that, just those pieces. But mm-hmm. It's like I would resist telling someone, like when they said they wanted to be an athlete or whatever. I said, okay, what's your plan B? Right, because that's only going to happen for a certain amount of time, and they would come up with something. So okay, I said, you know, what are you passionate about? And then they would explore that. So those are some things that I think. So the mentoring piece became pulling in different aspects of what people have poured into me, and try to bring that out into the students or young people that I come in contact with.
Yeah, as I'm listening to you, it's making me think about some of my work with identity, meaning, and purpose. And so with young people, young men in particular, they need a sense of that. Like, who am I? Who am I becoming? Who do I want to be? And so I guess you've done so much work with men in particular all across the age cohort, right? From elementary to college. Now I got men who are 18 to 26. And so what advice do you have for those people? Like, how do they make the most out of their 20s, the most out of this college experience, this time of their life? What would you say?
Well, I mean, one, the first thing I would say is take care of yourself. That's one of the first things, right? And, you know, like today I'm up here doing some presentations on mindfulness. And you know, I started out practicing as with transcendental meditation, and moved into now mindfulness-based stress reduction. And with that, it provides an opportunity for a person to increase their level of awareness. But simply, mindfulness is paying attention moment to moment, non-judgmentally. And so, when we look at that, that's one of the things. I think first developing a practice, a contemplative practice, that allows one to move from reactivity to being responsive, right? Mm. And then the other part is, when I talk about claiming your space, is really about taking an honest inventory of where you are. Like, what are your strengths? right? What are your strengths?
It's kind of scary to look at some of this stuff sometimes.
Yeah. However, one of the things, you know, to keep in mind is that many of the students stepped out of their comfort zone and applying for college.
Just even getting here and being on the campus. Just
getting here, so that's a part of the journey. So it's really being able to point out that they've already begun that process. And there's a part of them that's this whole idea of, as you know, as human beings, which is really a beautiful thing about us, is our ability to adapt, right? And that's a part. Our adaptability is one of the things that's helped us survive and thrive, right? So part of it is reconnecting them to the fact that you've already begun this journey. And now here's some other pieces that I think will help you on the way. And as a result of that is you developing a support system. So you seek the office hours of those people that can support you on your journey. Mm-hmm. Then the other part is, what are some other things that you can add to it? Is there an internship that you can get that would support you? What are some other things you can do? And here's one of the things for me that hindsight being 2020 and a student at UCSD, and I was a commuter student too. One of the things, going back, I wish I had done a study abroad program.
Me too. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because that was one of the things, when I think about my travels, even from being in the military, it really opened up my eyes. Because when I was in Japan, I would just get on my bike and get lost, right? And try to understand, you know, parts of the culture, you know, just find out which, you know, directions to different places. And then even later years in going to Africa and just, you know, things, you know, just the things that you pick up. So I would advise students to do that as well. And you may say, well, it's not possible. Well, it is. You just have to create a structure to make it happen. And that's the other part. And one of the things I was talking to students today about is create a vision board for yourself. And your intentions will guide your actions, right? So it's almost like, not that whole thing of I see it, I believe it, but when you set your intention and then work towards that, then you can make it happen. And so the wellness piece is a part of it. So that's the advice I'm giving. It's about wellness, but also tapping into your passion and then finding your support system. And then wherever there are gaps in your support system, recognize those gaps, but know that there are people that can still support you to get to where you want to be.
I'm afraid to ask for help.
Well, and see, that's the other part. So in terms of the courage, right? So, and this would be going back to even helping them explore. When you first thought about applying to college or on this journey to be here, what came up for you? What were you most concerned about? And then was there any concerns about fear that popped up for you? And if that's the case, what is it that you did to push you beyond that, right? Because you can help them tap into that whole notion of asking for help. What was the experience like when you did get help, right? Mm-hmm. And what is it about asking for help that has you thinking that there's some kind of weakness associated with that, right? So it's back to the whole, so claiming your space is really about asking critical questions, right? And one of the good things is, you know, I would like to do, I'm just going to put this out to you, because one of the things I like to do, a little book study with your group on the four pivots. That Dr. Sean Jenright mentions, right? Mm-hmm. And so I've been talking to the students. This is it's not a new concept to me. I remember seeing some work with the National Equity Project. But there's this idea of the window, the mirror, and the bridge, because they talk about a learning partnership, but I use it a little differently. And I talk about with each of us, there's a mirror that we look at because we know what's present for us. And in this mirror, we look out at the world and we examine how we fit into that, right? And we may have some concerns about that. But then there's a bridge that we can build to create some partnerships, right? On how can we manifest what it is that we aspire to know and be able to do, right? And that comes from just relationships. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I'd be interested in exposing them to is the work of John Powell out of the Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley. It's clear that we have to create some different language to look at this whole idea of othering and belonging. He talks about othering and belonging. Mm-hmm. All of us can relate to an experience that we've had that has created this sense of being othered. And we can connect to experiences that have created a sense of belonging for us. What happens is we get stuck on some old language, and that pretty much creates these fissures for us, mm-hmm. and not bridges. And so that's the other part that I'm interested in you know, if there's any way I can support you in your work,
absolutely,
you know, I'd be happy to do that. And it's been great being here today.
Yeah, thank you, Kasima. Really, a true pleasure, and a pioneer, a giant in the field, and glad to have you on. So any final words for students? I'm going to let you close us out today.
Well, one of the things I want to have you all do is just pause for a moment and ask yourself, what is it you're most passionate about? And then from that point, what I'm inviting you to do is identify some key mentors. I mean, you have Dr. Pope and some other folks, but identify some folks that can support you to create the things that you envision for yourself. And here's the other part. Step out of your comfort zone. You've already started it. Just be courageous. Peace.
Peace. The Home Base Podcast is a student success podcast recorded at the Digital Humanities Center at San Diego State University Library. Like, follow, subscribe. Find us on IG at SDSU_homebase.